Welcome to the Ireland Beyond Colonialism podcast. This podcast seeks to bring together diverse perspectives on how colonialism and coloniality manifest in our lives and projects being pursued that express a different way of being. It covers many broad topics including racism and white supremacy, colonialism, Irish history, Gaelic culture, mythology, climate breakdown, decolonization, anti-capitalism, queerness and gender issues, herbalism and foraging, spirituality and religion, and more as we see fit. The podcast is released on a monthly basis and can be supported through our Patreon. That's patreon.com/tishkintnataloon. That's spelled TUISCINTNATALUN. You can also find the Patreon link on the podcast page. In this episode, I speak with Lucy O'Hagan from Wild Awake. We speak about some overlapping elements of both our work, what it means to be involved in ancestral and land reconnection in Ireland at this historical juncture, and more. As always, I hope you take something from the conversation. You can find Lucy's work at wildawake.ie.
Hiya, Lucy.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me today to the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
All right, so for listeners who may not know who you are, although I'm pretty sure all my listeners probably do, would you like to introduce yourself and say briefly what it is that you do with Wild Awake?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Lucy O'Hagan. I'm from Belfast and I'm currently in Dúnanál, where my heart lives. And I've been running an organization, a passion project, continually unfolding being since 2017. And before that, since 2015, I was running a forest school in Dublin's Phoenix Park. So, yeah, Wild Awake was born out of that. My mission with that is to rekindle cultural and ecological resilience through the learning of ancestral skills, through the restoration of ancestral life ways and place-based relationships. So currently working a lot with teenagers in rites of passage work and adults and still some forest school work. I'll just leave it there.
Cool. How did you first realize the necessity of ancestral recovery work, and what then initially spurred your decision to commit your life, your entire life to it?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think in that wording, like how I realized the importance of restoring ancestral life ways, that's actually a really recent thing. You know, and that's still really unfolding, that it's like in the context of everything that's happening in the world right now, to be like, oh right, okay, this is actually what I'm doing. And sometimes it feels like what I'm doing is defined within the context of, well, of course it is, it's defined within the context of the wider culture, but also the people that are turning up to my classes and what they're witnessing and experiencing from it. So I think, like, I suppose when I think about what I'm doing in terms of an entity, it's kind of growing in response to the relationships that's developing with people. And in terms of like my own journey with this work, it was definitely like born out of like healing a relationship with myself first and foremost. You know, when I first started doing environmental education, it was really like, yeah, I want to save the world. This is like what I want to do and this is how I'm going to do it. And when I was like doing environmental education work, I became aware very quickly that it was not having an impact. You know, I was going into schools, talking to kids about climate change, you know, teaching them how to make like bug hotels, and it was just, it felt so ineffective. It felt so ineffective, and it felt really difficult to go back into a school environment and to try and reconnect kids with what? Like, I don't know what I was trying to connect kids with, because it was happening in a classroom. And it was really when I did forest school training that it kind of awoke something in me, which was, you know, about nature connection and about like developing this relationship with the place that we're in, and then going out and being in nature with young people and with families, that I really started to see where that change could happen. And that it was so, I don't know, the ground was so ready for it. And like, I often think about like how sad it is, like with any of my work, you know, but like with forest school work in particular, how sad it is that it exists, you know. Be like, oh God, I hate that my job exists, you know. I hate that I'm being paid to take kids out into nature for them to build dens or to like play, as if, you know, it's such a cultural hole, isn't it, when you're paying somebody else to do the things that we even grew up doing, you know. So I think it's been like, you know, I suppose we know this, it wasn't like one moment of like, this is like the moment I realized it was important. It was very gradual. And the ways in which I see that it's important is changing and growing all the time as well.
That's really interesting. So it's been a gradual thing. I didn't realize that the idea around this being ancestrally necessary was only a sort of more recent thing in your work. I for some reason I thought it was kind of like the genesis of it. So you say that it started with you wanting to heal a relationship with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And how then did you come to the realization that healing a relationship with yourself was also, or necessitated healing a relationship with what we call nature?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose over time, like we hear, you know, we are nature all the time. And, you know, how many times can we hear that before you actually feel it, do you know? And I sometimes feel like it is still a constant reminder of, you know, there's so many things, like so many structures that are here to separate us from that idea and to separate us from that truth, you know. Yeah, I kind of lost my train of thought there, but like definitely coming back to that all the time of like, I am nature. And so if I'm healing myself and working on my relationship with myself, then that's automatically like feeds into being in relationship with the land and with other people. And that we're all a part of this. I'm going to keep saying that. We're all a part of this, you know. Yeah, it's definitely been a gradual thing.
And as you say, and I do feel this about my own work too, that like the fact that it's necessary is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we have to, you know, spend our energy, our life's energy, on this, essentially trying to address disconnection.
Yeah.
Like systemic disconnection of people from the land, which we are the land.
Yeah.
As you say. So, you know, how did that happen in the first place? Why is our work necessary? And yeah, so then it's sort of like the work that we do is almost like out of place.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't belong in a society that is based on, that built on and relies on this connection to even operate in the first place, right?
Yeah.
So that makes me think, given how, this is a bit of a long question now, but given how we've been conditioned and structurally made to be completely dependent on the colonial regime of extraction, that is annihilating the basis of most life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to me to be a very difficult gap to bridge between the kinds of skills and ways of being that you're creating pedagogical spaces for those becoming a hobby versus being an entire way of being, knowing, and existing in the world as it was for our ancestors for eons or for all of human existence. So what I mean is our dependency on colonial ways of being that we also reproduce, it seems like a pretty extreme obstacle to thinking and acting, because really decolonization and engaging in this kind of cultural revitalization work means trying to recreate an otherwise, right, to colonial ways of being that are in tune with our ancestral ways of being. So if we're comfortable in the colonial way of being that we've been raised to be dependent on, going to the woods and engaging in these types of practices can then, as I see it at least, easily just become pastime activities that give us the illusion of doing something when they actually fit neatly into how our lives are otherwise, which could then also have the effect of entrenching the colonial way of being more deeply in our lives because we think we're doing something to change it when we're not. So in other words, this profoundly necessary cultural work becomes a hobby in our lives rather than a way of being. And it's the colonial way of being which we live that is causing the totalizing predicament that we're in. Do you think you'd be able to speak to that tension, maybe how you see it arising in your practices?
Yeah, I mean,
how you feel it or navigate it.
Yeah, like, and thank you so much for speaking to that. Like, it's so important. And yeah, I mean, I think I want to begin by just saying that, like, I don't want to say I don't judge, but I don't want to feel that there's judgment towards people who do need to do that, because systemically, like, they're making money to, you know, survive. Like, whether they're just organizing an afternoon, which does feed into this idea of like a pastime. But I think with my work and like the kind of person that I am, I'm constantly coming back to the question of like, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing and how am I doing this? And is this still part of the same mission? And what am I doing and how am I doing this? And like something that's become really clear this year, like when I developed this 7-month program, the Awakening, is very much like coming out of lockdown and feeling like I don't want to run these day long or afternoon events for people anymore. And if I am, I want it to be very clear that it is just like, it's really just people dipping their toe into something, which is relationship building. Do you know, like, it's all relationship building and like constantly coming back to that question of like, well, what is rewilding? Because I think we need to be really astute to the words that have become sexy and have been commoditized, like rewilding and connection and belonging. And like, I heard Martin Shaw talk on a podcast about, you know, grief being the new sexy, you know, like all these words that are dropped in of like, oh, like, that's what I want. I want connection, because we're all hungering after that. Well, you know, come to my class and pay this much and I will give you that feeling of connection. Like, you know, fuck that. Like, and at the same time, like, yeah, like, we're living in this system. And okay, if there is like somebody feeling that for a little while, well, then maybe that will branch on to other things. But yeah, anyway, I came out of lockdown feeling, right, I want something more in depth with people. I want something that's not just me as, like, I'm doing air quotes now, but like the teacher, and you're the learners, that is like a collaboration between lots of different voices, that is like not one person holds the truth, you know, like these are all different components of a story. And yeah, that like we need all of those voices, you know, like we need all the different pieces of this story to kind of come back to ourselves in a way. So yeah, I mean, like what keeps coming back in my mind is like this idea of relationship building, and how when I take people out for, like, if I'm teaching about plants, you know, or if I'm teaching about mushrooms or wildlife and tracking, or anything, that it's like constantly this relationship tending that won't happen in an afternoon or a day or a year or in isolation by yourself. You know, it's like, it's it's kind of everything, and also being so aware of like the systems that we're living in, which is a system of extraction and of commoditized relationships. So like I can pay for this, and then I am now entitled to go out and to pick that plant and to use it and to eat it, like rather than approaching that plant and like cultivating a relationship and coming to know it through the seasons and coming to know like who it likes to grow with and where it likes to grow and in what season and what different weather patterns affect it. So it's like, yeah, okay, we're learning about those communities, and then how do we, you know, I do love being by myself outside, but also, you know, how do we come together in for these harvests like we used to do? There's so many different levels of change that need to happen. And I'm also thinking about like, you know, all of these different points of entry for people. Like the work I like, you know, I do everything from like the Sailed Away thing, which is like heavily committed program, to like forest school training, to, you know, sometimes like short walks or day longs. And it's like wherever I can meet people, kind of be at the door and say, okay, like, have you considered this way? Then that's really important as well. That it's like, I think it's really powerful with the forest school training, do you know, because it's an accredited training and we're meeting people at the store where they've maybe been in a school, they've been taught a school their whole life. And this is the first time that somebody's spoken to them about like tending a relationship with a plant or showing them how to create a fire. And I just think it's really important to create all as many points as possible where people can enter into this. I was chatting about this with my friend this morning where we were talking about, you know, like all of the scientific evidence around like you know, gut flora and the gut like being the brain of the body, you know, and you know, in some circles it's like, well, listen to your instinct. And it's like, well, if people have been cut off from that for so long that they can't even hear that word like instinct without going straight to like that's some hippie bullshit, like I don't want to engage with it. But if somebody comes, well, actually the science with this is this, you know, or like this idea that plants are sentient, you know, like so not that long ago people would have thought that that was complete crap, like, you know, but now it's like there's so much science to back it up. So if that is another entry point for people to come in and say, well, I can re-engage with this now because I trust in this research, then it's like, I don't know, it's just like another way of getting people in, even though, you know, our ancestors might have felt this deep in their bones and it was their way of life, but that's not where we are right now. So yeah, I think it's so important to be aware of it. And I really, I've appreciated that so much this year. Like it was one of the big, my big learnings from this year was being like confronted with like, okay, we're talking about creating community, but actually, are we doing that, you know, or is it just like this class is over and that's the end of it? And that's really painful, do you know? And I think as a teacher and as somebody who is doing this for their work, it's like really good to be challenged by that, you know, and also to be honest in, well, this is where this is my work and these are the relationships that I have and here are my boundaries as well. So yeah, it's just good not to fool ourselves, especially now, you know, it's really good to be honest about these things, even if it's yeah, it's not what the course outline said, you know. So yeah, thanks for that question, Jimmy, and I could
Oh,
tell you.
that was a great answer. Thanks so much for your honesty. Which leads me on to another thing I wanted to ask you, which was like recognizing that a land-based existence was also a communal one for our ancestors, and that communality or community is what we need to recreate. In order to have any hope of shifting the weight of colonial modernity off of ourselves, how do we address and avoid gatekeeping and exclusionary practices? because we both charge money for what we do, because that's what we have to do to be able to do what we do and survive capitalism at the same time. But both of our work could obviously do with far more financial accessibility. Like, paywalls are essentially anti-community. I know this is for sure something you think about a lot. Maybe you could share your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's always something that's been really important in my work, to have like levels of accessibility, financial, okay? And I think it's important to make that distinction, because like finance is just one barrier, do you know? There's also like time, poverty, and so many different systematic reasons why somebody might not have the time or feel safe to come out into the woods to learn these skills. So I think it's important to recognize that there are many different barriers which have been constructed. I think throughout the years of doing this work, I was thinking, okay, I'll always like charge less and less and less, to the point where it was really hard to continue what I was doing, because I wasn't, I don't know, like people maybe not understanding what sliding scale means, or being open to be honest about where they might fit on that. But also, like, if I was considering, well, who are the communities that are most marginalized, and actually they're not seeing my work for many different reasons, that it was more about going into those communities and actively seeking them out to build relationships. And like that ebb and that ebbs and flows, you know, because it takes time to build those relationships of trust, particularly between communities where there has been so much mistrust constructed as well. And yeah, like something that I'm thinking about is, like not just, okay, I'm charging money and like that's necessary for me to survive in this world, but also that like the ways in which I'm tricked into this system in terms of my own self-worth. And yeah, I mean, I know, you know, that I have a problem with this of just like working so much, because like I really care about the work and I feel really good in the spaces that are created, because, you know, my work aims to like create spaces that are welcoming for people who have often been like made to believe that they don't belong, which is me. So when I meet these people in the woods, I feel great, you know. And I am so passionate about sharing this. So I have a tendency to overwork, which is like another symptom of capitalism, you know. So like, how do I remind myself to create spaces that are not monetary, that are just open to people coming together who want to, you know, harvest plants or swim in the sea or go for a walk or scrape hides together, you know, like there are so many points along like the calendar. Now, I want to say for our ancestors, but now still, you know, there is still a time when it's like there is an abundance of acorns that you need loads of community to crack, like, or the time when the cull is happening or the rivers are open that people traditionally would have come together to celebrate those things. So I think that's something that I'm still learning, that I really appreciate more people coming together who have interests in doing these things, because it's fairly niche as well. Do you know, it's like, I don't know loads of people who want to do this. And also people like, I'm talking about me giving myself the time to do these things, but other people giving themselves the time to do these things when it's not something that they've paid for, that they know that it's important to carve out that time and space just to build relationships, which can lead to community. But I think that's why I love coming back to Dunanall, to Donegal all the time, because it's like the place where I feel that, you know, it's the place where like I have actual like family like biological family here, but also it's the place where I've grown up and I know local people and I can call into people's houses and I have relationships with particular like rivers and particular bits of bog that it's like you're kind of like going and visiting those places and feeling that actual belonging to a place.
You know, and this kind of relates to what we were saying earlier as well, like what you do is so necessary because of the way the world is. And yet, as you say, it's extremely niche.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really frightening, actually. I kind of, when you said it's a really niche thing, I kind of paused and I felt a bit panicked. Because, and particularly when you're completely immersed in something and thinking about it all the time, and most of the people you're talking to around you are also immersed in it, you can forget that it is actually a very niche thing.
Yeah.
So I feel a question around that.
Mm.
And I feel it may be kind of unanswerable in a way. It's just one of these things, a byproduct of the way society is shaped, global colonial society, if you like, and the way it makes us as people, the way it conditions us as people. But what do you think are the main social or cultural or structural obstacles to getting people out and engaged and even aware? Like even having this on their radar is a thing that might be good for them to engage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose we, and you know, like it was a long process of colonization to remove us from the land and to remove us from these ways of life. And, you know, I'm thinking a lot about the Irish language at the moment and really wanting to learn and am like learning the Irish language again, and it's so interesting like what that brings up for me, you know. And speaking as somebody who was raised in the north of Ireland, there's so much fear, and I know that that is my fear, and it's also my ancestors' fear, you know, that of like learning and speaking our native tongue again, you know. So yeah, that's one thing that comes up for me. And that's huge. Like, I can't fathom the pain and the oppression that was inflicted for this to become so niche, like for this to become like this relationship with the land that sustains us. And when we look to the language, so many of the words are direct experiences from the land and are evolutions of relationships with the land. Like the amount of pain that must have been inflicted to sever that and to make that even something that's become so elite. And I suppose I really want to talk to the beauty of like those words as well. I've been reading this, the Malcolm McGann's book. I kind of dip in and out of it quite a lot, the 32 words for field, and then the new one, the Tree Dogs and Banshee Fingers. And like when he's saying words and phrases, it's like, I know that, you know.
Yeah.
There's one word, rock, and it's like the movement of the water where there's seaweed below it. So it's like the movement of the water in relationship to the seaweed where it wrinkles and crinkles. It's like, well, I know that because I've spent time harvesting seaweed. Or that like there would be a word for, you know, an animal's hoof print that gets filled in with water. It's like, okay, when we spend time in the land, it's like you see all of these things all the time. And you know that like, of course there's a word for that, you know.
Yeah.
Like he talked about like this ritual of like putting rush lamps into the river. And we did that on one of the rites of passage, like unbeknownst to us that there was a word for that in Irish. So it's like, oh my God, like it's so alive and so in us and so ready to be brought back out into the open again. So yeah, like what are the things that are stopping us? Well, like generations of pain and oppression, and then how has this become something that's like a hobby? I mean, it's like all of those structures which mean that people don't have time or don't have money or feel like they don't belong. Like that is so painful, like that you're like constantly having to, like, how do I sell a course that's like, do you want to feel belonging? Like that's so, like it's so tragic. And it's like, at what point then do we say, like, do we actually reclaim that and say, well, I do belong here, and like more than that, like it's, yeah, there's so much like there's so much pain. And yeah, I mean, I know Martin Shaw is talking about grief being sexy, but it is so vital as well. And I love that you talk about that in your work as well, that there needs to be like that, the tending to the grief of it, as well as not getting stuck in it as well, as well as like being able to move through it. And that takes community as well, doesn't it? To like lift a person out of that and then, okay, well, let's engage with our imaginations again, which have also been commoditized and like weathered by colonization. How do we re-engage with our imaginative meaning-making selves who brought those words into being, who like engaged with the land in this way to create like beautiful crafts? Like I think about like the willow baskets and all of our heritage crafts, like how much beauty was made with our hands, like to bring that part of ourselves to light again.
Barry Lopez said that we should always balance grief with rejuvenation, because if we lean too much into grief, then we can just drown in it, right?
Yeah, absolutely, especially now.
But what you're saying there is setting off all kinds of lights inside my being. Like, it's sort of like, I feel like the task of both of our work really then is sort of like activating remembering in people for what we have here, because we don't en masse, like, we have this cultural trauma of like just chronic self-doubt, and we just don't realize what we have because we only speak English, as you say, mostly. And that's the colonizer's tongue. So therefore, if our entire world of knowing is only within the colonizer's tongue, therefore we only live within the colonizer's imagination, and therefore of the colonizer's view of us, which, as we know, was and is not favorable to us and who we are and who the land is here. And that's because our education system here is a continuation of the British colonial education system, which was designed in the first place to eradicate the language from our ancestors. And something else I noticed was that a lot of people I've come across who, remembered, as we have through our own paths, who have remembered and realized what we have here in ourselves and in the land, were people that went somewhere else. People that traveled to India, or they traveled to South America or whatever, they spent time there, they saw people of tradition, that were still immersed in their cultural practices. And then they realized, wait, I can see something here in what they're doing that is absent at home, but still present, and sort of asking what happened to it. So it's like you had to go away to realize what you actually had at home.
Yeah, and I suppose I want to add, like, from a personal perspective as well, like, when I did that and I came home, I didn't think I was coming back to anything, you know? Like, I think, like, growing up in the north, it's like anything to do with, even though, like, my dad, I grew up like between the north and the south because my dad lives in the south and we were up in Donegal all the time. It still didn't feel like my culture, do you know? And it was like engaging with Irish language or mythology or heritage or anything like that felt out of bounds. Like it felt like it didn't belong to me. And I think I shared with you recently of like, I still get that from people in Ireland of, well, you're British, like telling me that I'm British because I was born in the north. And it's so painful. And I think that's why I feel so passionate about the work that I do as well, because it is like that reclaiming of something that I was told that didn't belong to me, but I know that it does. And like, how do you kind of move through that when you're constantly being told or, yeah, like, or feeling that this isn't mine and this isn't mine to engage with? Like how ridiculous that is when it's like, well, how old is this border? You know, like we've been here on this land engaging with these traditions for so much longer than any of this, you know. So yeah, I think I feel it feels important for me to speak to that part of my identity more and more, actually.
I have a, I guess I have a question around that then. And this may I could be totally off, and feel free to tell me if I'm totally off with this, but is the sort of in some ways like an appropriation of the aesthetic of Gaelicness by opportunistic Republican groups who want to use it for political ends or whatever. Do you feel like that might be part of why you or others might feel an aversion or a disconnect from it?
I mean, certainly, yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Like how mythology is appropriated for sectarian or racist ends, you know, like it's really infuriating. And I think like when I was growing up, it was really important for me to be able to navigate many worlds. Like yeah, like we're Irish Catholic family, but then my mom married into like a Presbyterian area that was very yeah, there was a lot of Orange Order around, you know, so it was really staunchly unionist, and it was really important to be able to blend in and to be able to yeah, be hidden. Which is like also, you know, like as a queer person, you know, it's like you're hiding that part of yourself as well and become quite adept at like adapting like adapting to what's happening around. So I think my whole life, like certainly my younger life, was just about like trying to adapt to wherever I was. And definitely, you know, in the north, it's like the people who are like identify as unionist, like they're often called more English than the English. And like the people who identify as strongly nationalist, it's like it's so important for them that like the Irish language and culture is a big visual part of who they are, you know. And I think I was listening to an interview with NECAP recently, and they spoke really well to that, you know, of like, yeah, like we're constantly being told that like we don't exist actually, but like we're just trying to engage with our culture and our heritage just as anybody might be. But yeah, it's certainly like I remember, I think I said this to you, like going to Dublin with like a friend and going into a bar, and there was like the proclamation of 1916 and a tricolor on the wall, and my whole nervous system was instantly like, this is not a safe place to be, we need to leave. Because if it was in the north, it would be, like you're very much like in a specific area, and that was strongly associated with violence and conflict. And that's been such a journey for me with this work as well, of like trying to make peace with conflict, like to be recognize how important it is to be able to have and to move through. And I don't know if that answers your question, but that's just some musings.
Some thoughts. Yeah, well, it's all super good to hear anyway. Yeah, maybe we could talk a little bit about that then, because it's been something that's been present for me as well recently, and I've been thinking a lot about it. I've been thinking a lot about the some of the anchoring things of Irish culture, I suppose, which, when I think about them more, like fear of conflict, for example, which you just mentioned. When I think about them more, I'm like, Gaelic chieftains and poets 1,000 years ago, they definitely didn't have these characteristics. They're so clearly a product of being stood on for hundreds of years. And coming out the other end of that, not knowing who you are and not having any confidence. And also of trying to survive the boot for so long. Just being afraid of any conflict. And I can feel that, sometimes even with the most minor things with people in my life, sometimes I can feel a disproportionate level of fear arise in my body. I can feel the hormones being produced and pumped through my body, and my heart races. And it's, if I was imagining myself like from a distance looking down on the situation, I would think that's completely ridiculous. Why would you, why would you feel nervous or panicked about something that isn't even conflict, and it's so minor. So you're saying it's present for you as well, but it's something that's so omnipresent in Irish society. And yeah, I don't know, maybe you can speak a bit more about how you've seen it come up, or how you've been dealing with it, or.
I mean, I suppose it's just it's an ongoing process, and it's all around us, like it's in nature as well. Like it's conflict is everywhere. And I'm thinking about I don't know if you've ever seen spalting on wood before. It's like you'll see on like birch wood or beech wood, and it looks like when you chop it open, it's like these black lines in the wood, and it's really prized wood, it's really, really beautiful. And that's a result of like two like fungi coming together. It's called like an endophyte, and then it's like a war, like we're say like watching a conflict between two mycorrhizals coming together. And it's like, it's so beautiful, and like it's so present all around us all the time. And even saying that now, it's like I can feel my body relaxing into that knowing of like, oh yeah, okay, like this is a really natural whatever thing to do. And yet, as you're saying, I think it's really important to recognize like the ancestral wounding of that, like how that has been a consistent message of like not engaging with conflict and trying to survive and navigating and adapting, which is, a survival skill. For me, a large part of moving through that is therapy. I do a lot of somatic therapy, and it's like, like constantly doing like in this therapy, I'm really, really lucky to have like an incredible therapist who we do a lot of like meditations and ancestral healing work together as well, of like recognizing like what's not mine and like visualizing that and passing that back through the generations of like, thank you, like that's not my shame, you know, like I don't need that. And really feeling the support and the relief of ancestors when we do that as well. And it's, yeah, I feel very fortunate to be in collaborations with people like professionally where I can name when that's coming up for me, you know, like I can name like this is a really, really difficult thing for me to say, or like, you know, to be able to move through that with people is like such a gift actually, and has taken a really long time where I haven't just completely froze or, you know, gone into things that I didn't feel completely comfortable with, or knowing the importance of like communicating and having difficult conversations before working with people. And yeah, then in my own life as well, like recognizing when relationships aren't healthy anymore, and as painful as they are, like needing to set those aside for a little while. But it's definitely like a relearning, like a really lifelong, like generations spanning tending, you know. And I know we speak about this a lot together, and of like that this is not going to happen in one lifetime, you know. And it's like both kind of terrifying and also like relieving to think that as well, that like, oh fuck, like are we not gonna get to a time when this is gonna, I feel like I've got this, you know, and maybe I will and something else will come up, but just like constantly doing that work. And I felt that really strongly in the beginning of my journey in this work, of just feeling that like this is where this stops, like, you know, like this pain that I'm feeling, like I'm not carrying this anymore. And maybe, you know, maybe an ancestor thought that before me and it recontinued again, but just like having that conscious moment of like, no, it's not going any further. And then yeah, exploring how to do that with help from many, many different people and many different practices. But yeah, I love that idea of like these, you know, the Philly and the poets, and how did they engage with this, and like how did that feel at that time? And
yeah, it's interesting, like thinking intergenerationally, you know, and when you say no, this stops with me and the people around me, and we all agree it stops here. You know, we're not just doing that for ourselves, we're in a huge way doing it for the people that come after us more so.
Yeah.
You know, okay, there's some other stuff I want to jump into as well. I'm just cognizant of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll jump into this question, which is not related to what we were just talking about.
Okay.
But it's something I really want to address. So in the spheres of this work, ancestral and land reconnection practices and so on, I feel like there's an ever-present danger of cultural theft.
Mm-hmm.
And even without realizing when we might be participating in it.
Mm-hmm.
And one way that can happen is because there's several degrees of separation between the person doing the practice and like where the theft actually originally happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but without knowing the origins of a practice, and why and how it makes its way into our field of vision at all, you know, we just perpetuate the colonial dynamics. Mm. And so I suppose in the Anglosphere, we're obviously influenced in particular by settler colonial ways of thinking from the Anglophone settler states, especially obviously so-called United States. And this happens in all areas of our lives, as we know, including in practice. This is very important, including in practices and organizations that are trying to create radical alternatives mm-hmm. to capitalism. And so in ancestral and land reconnection, it appears to me that some settler colonial methodologies have probably traveled across the ocean to Ireland that were originally co-opted by settlers from Indigenous peoples whose lands they occupy, or at best, these things were fed to them by what are referred to by Indigenous people as plastic shamans.
Mm.
And so while the goal is not to attempt to recreate the past, nor is it to be impossibly insular, my question is, how in Ireland do we attempt to create something that is really ours, like that is in tune with our ancestral past, rather than basing what we do on gifts given to us that were stolen from someone else?
Mm.
In short, I suppose, it's how do we avoid replicating coloniality and whiteness in what we're trying to create?
Mm-hmm. Is that all? yeah.
Long-winded questions.
They're good. It's good. I appreciate them. It's so important. I mean, I suppose I often think about, like, there's such, like, for all the efforts to erase our cultural practices, we still have so much available to us here, you know, like in terms of like the folklore archives and physical places, you know, like megalithic sites, and there's still so much available to us here to engage with. And with that, you know, I'm not here studying the archives all the time or know everything about megalithic sites. So there's something about like this being a really collective effort across many different disciplines to try and uncover practices, and also having access to those places as well, do you know, like having access to sites, so I think that's like one thing, is like as many different people in the conversation as possible, who are like could want to do this. And like I'm thinking a lot about, like, I love self-generated ceremony, you know, and it's something that I speak to a lot, because I think when I was re-engaging with ritual and ceremony after a lifetime of growing up in Catholicism and then rejecting anything that was like remotely spiritual, like figuring out that I could craft my own ceremony again was really empowering. Also with the, you know, like I was doing that whilst also not wanting to culturally appropriate. And I think that was another big reason why I it took me a really long time to come back to ritual and to ceremony, because I was so afraid of doing that, actually. That like knowing that I could go out onto the land and like through building these relationships with the land, come to know in whatever way I know the qualities of certain places or certain beings, and like the symbols and the myths, and engaging with that world in that way, that it then became like living ceremony, you know, that it's like, okay, I'm just figuring out if I'm making sense here. But I suppose for me, it's like when we're creating culture or we're creating ceremony, like it's so important that it's alive and that it's relevant for the people that are practicing it. And when I actually haven't been to, well, I not consciously, I don't think I have been to any, you know, what I would consider what are very culturally appropriative ceremonies, like sweat lodges held in the Dakota tradition that would happen here. Like, I've never been to those, but I can only imagine that if I was there, I wouldn't understand it, you know, like, because it's not meant for me. So, like, how can I engage with it in a way that is meaningful and significant to me, where I am now, to my ancestors here, to the world that we're creating, like what is going to make sense and what is going to be meaningful? And you know, that's not to say that like I'm going to be in a ceremony speaking Irish and it's going to make sense to me either, because I'm not going to understand what we're saying too, you know? So I don't
That
know,
in
like,
between, the sort of in between state we're in.
but it's just like, yeah, something that I just keep coming back to is that like it needs to make sense. And yeah, maybe it does make sense to somebody to take something from a different culture and use it in their ceremony, but then I think that like maybe they're engaging in ceremony in a different way to me. I feel like I'm really rambling and not making sense, but it only that it just like for this to work, it needs to be like it needs to be alive and well and significant for the people that are there, and that's how it will continue, you know. And if it's something that we're continuing on for the past, like, is it still relevant to what we're doing now?
Yeah, I suppose the danger that I see is that practices are appropriated from elsewhere without any bad intention, that is, like by well-meaning people. And then a sort of a Celtic or a Gaelic glaze or a veneer is put over these practices. You know, just different names on practices that are coming from somewhere else or some other people, and that weren't necessarily given to you with consent. Not you personally.
I mean, I think it's really important to hold that question and to bring awareness to that, and to kind of speak to that one in us which is so hungry for something meaningful that they will just take something from elsewhere because there's that hunger for vulnerability, do you know?
I want to touch on something else you mentioned there, which has been something I've been thinking a lot about recently, and that's the rejection of anything remotely spiritual. This is something, and now this isn't backed by any statistics or numbers or anything, but I would safely say that, you know, a majority at this point of Irish people have sort of by and large rejected Catholicism. And through that, as you said, rejected everything else, like anything remotely to do with anything spiritual or not, you know, completely materialist and based in scientific fact. I just feel like a discussion around this could be really useful for maybe people who are listening who are, you know, who have, you know, rightly rejected that stuff, you know, and to recognize that like it's a trauma response really. And that I think both of us have been there in that place where we've rejected it and we feel, you know, very confidently atheist or whatever. But I guess it's like leaving the question mark there or something, you know, being open to an otherwise.
Something that I'm thinking about is like the rites of passage work that I'm doing, and I was approached by a group of parents from Dublin who, you know, their kids go to a non-denominational school and they're not taking their Holy Communion, but they knew the importance of something, do you know? They didn't know what, they just knew that something was missing. And we spoke about that, you know, of like how Catholicism had imposed Holy Communion confirmation right at the points where there are these changes happening, do you know? So like, yes, we would have had rituals before then because this is like, you know, 7, 8 years old. It's like the first time that you're experiencing yourself as separate from your family. It's like this loss of innocence. It's where a lot of young children are finding out that certain things that aren't real, but it's a definite, it's a developmental stage essentially. As is the transition from childhood into well, what we have now called adolescence, but like young adulthood. And so anyway, they came together because they wanted to mark this. And yeah, they decided to call it an Octra, like so a kind of adventure, Ushgilga. So it was a group of 8-year-olds. And we together like crafted something that made sense for their community. You know, it was like, well, why, like just asking those questions, like, why do you want this? Like, what is important to you collectively as a group of parents? Like, what is, like, what do you want these young people to know about you as a community? Like, what are you marking? What are they coming from? What are they going into? And then we just held like a really, you know, I met them at like various different times over the year just to like build that relationship and to like generate those kinds of conversations happening. And then we held like a really simple ritual where the young people were invited to like consider the gifts that they were bringing for their community, to find something to represent that, and then to bring that. Yeah, it was an alternative to Holy Communion. And there were grandparents there, and there were, you know, aunties and uncles there. And there were people who, you know, might have wanted those children to have a Holy Communion. Like, I'm thinking about the grandparents or whatever, you know, but it was like just providing this space for an alternative that still engages with ritual and still engages with like something larger, with something like the unseen or mystery or spirit or whatever way people engage with it, you know. That then, you know, these young people were sitting around the fire and we could hear the younger ones speaking to one another and saying, are you going to make your Octra or are you going to make your Holy Communion, you know? And it's like, all right, this is like how new things are born that are like drawing on the past to try and create an alternative future, you know? So I think like it's a really, you know, it's a really real and felt thing that we're talking about, that people have just disconnected from anything that would engage with the other world or spirituality. And yeah, it's like some people mightn't ever come back to that. And it's so hard, you know. But it's like as many different, I mean, I've spoken about this already, but like, as many different entry points as is possible for people to re-engage with that, you know, and with the rites of passage work, like that's been really powerful, actually, that, you know, a group of teenagers have come into the woods and after a week, they're all talking about like their relationship with the land and like receiving messages from and teachings from trees and moths and rivers and yeah, like I think like that's it's a really potent way in. It was my way in back into it, you know, that it was just like re-engaging with the animate world around me and you know, these ecological relationships to like I talk a lot about like our ecological niche, you know, and that feels like one of the guiding questions of my work is like, what is our ecological niche as humans, you know? And I feel like a whole like sitting in ritual together is like one of the most human things that we can do, and marking important transitions. For people.
It's amazing. Can I ask you how you went about creating the Octra?
Yeah. So like, as I said, I was approached by a group of parents already, which was kind of amazing. Because with the other rites of passage work, it's like, you know, people are coming from all over the country, so they don't have a connection already. But this was like a group of parents that already knew each other, that had already decided that they wanted something different. So I spoke with the parents, first of all, about rites of passage, about why we might want or need to mark these transitions, particularly at like 7 or 8, which for me is a lot about like creating or like re-inspiring a language of initiation, you know, that people feel comfortable talking about change and feel comfortable like naming that change, particularly for the young people, so that the young people, when they reach like one of the biggest changes that they're going to go through, which is that change from like childhood into adolescence, that they know that there's already like an openness within the community to talk about change and to market. So it's kind of like laying the foundations for that already. So we talked about that, you know, you're trying to get people on board a little bit in whatever way is possible. And, you know, people sharing their stories of their Holy Communion as well, like that they really remember it, you know, because it was created as a space apart. Like it did feel very different, you know. It wasn't just like your everyday day. Like it was for all of it. Like, you know, I know it's a lot about money and what people are wearing and stuff, but like it does feel like something very different is happening. So we're kind of like talking about like what is it about that? Like, why is it important that we would feel something outside of, you know, like moving into this other world? Like, why would we need to feel something just like outside of our everyday and ordinary lives? And then it was like really putting it back to them of like, you know, a rite of passage. Like a rite is a ritual, and it's like marking a passage from something into something, you know. Like when we went to Ó na Gcath, it's like that moment of being outside of the cave, and that moment of entering, and then that moment of being in the cave, and then that moment of leaving the cave, and then what is the place that you're arriving back to, you know. Like they need to be distinct, otherwise it's just another day, you know. So like what was going to be different for these young people? Like what new responsibilities were they going to give? Were they willing to give them? And like why? Like why do they need this? You know, and I think it's really important to come back to that, like of like why do you need this as a community? Like why is it important that your young person recognizes that there's been a change? Yeah, like taking time to sit with those questions. So I kind of was like generated a lot of discussion questions around that that they could then go away with as parents and to talk about. And what they came back with was like, well, it's for us, it's a lot about the community that we're in. I was like, right, okay, so what is it that these young people are bringing to their community? So they'd again went back again and took the young people out for a really long hike. You know, in as much as they can, like these are 7 and 8 year olds who are just like, I just want to run away and play. Like, I don't want to listen to you talk to me about change. You know, they think it's maybe something to do with their bodies changing. Like it is that, but it's not that as well. Like, you know, there's so many other changes that are happening in the brain and in culture and what is expected of people as they grow older and change. So yeah, they came back, and then it was just constantly going back to them of what felt comfortable, you know. Like, so we just had a day in the woods where the young people were invited to come up and to be witnessed in their gifts, you know. And hopefully they'll remember that, you know. I never had that day. I don't remember that, you know, but it's definitely not something that ever would have happened to me. And I feel like, oh yeah, it would have been really different if I'd heard the adults in my life recognize the gift that I was bringing to the world and really celebrate that. Yeah, and then like I suppose the one of the most important parts of any rites of passage is this incorporation stage, you know, this reintegration, which is why rites of passage so often don't happen now, because we're creating something which would have been created by a community for a community in the absence of community, you know. So it's a really difficult part. And you know, myself and Catherine and Niamh, who work together on True Nature for the teenagers, it's something we talk about a lot of like, how do we make sure that this isn't just like an amazing experience for young people, which then, you know, at you know, on one end of the spectrum could just fade away into the background of their memories, or it could be a potentially really traumatizing thing, you know, where they suddenly awaken to their true purpose in life and their relationship with the land, and then are told, like, well, no, actually, you're just, you know, whoever, you know, you're not this, and what are you talking about, a relationship with the land? So it was really great that this group of parents had approached me as an already existing community of people, and that there were then suggestions of how to keep this alive. So for them, we'd created like a little bundle with all of the young people's gifts in the bundle, and that's currently traveling around all of the different families. And the job, as it were, like the service of the family who holds it for 1 month, is to craft something for the community to bring them together. So whether that's like a dinner or a walk or a movie night, or it's like, yeah, engage with your imagination to keep this alive, you know, because it can so easily just be forgotten and we move on with our lives. And yeah, so that's kind of how we did it. It was definitely a co-creation, and I should say that they came up with the word Octra, and I think it's gorgeous. And yeah, I really would incur. I think it's important that it happens like within those communities as much as possible. When I say within the communities that we find ourselves in, yeah.
I think that story is a beautiful reminder of the reality of not having intact communities anymore because of colonialism, and the significantly hard work that it would take from loads of people. It can't just be one person trying to do it to actually rebuild it.
Yeah.
You know, and that sounds amazing. Do I have time for another question?
Go on. No, you can have one more question, Jimmy.
Okay. This might be a bit of a turn now, but we'll go for it. Fascism, ethno-nationalism, ableism, and queer phobia, among other nasty things, unfortunately, all have a definite presence in ancestral and land connection spheres. And I think this is a symptom of the chaos being generated by the collapse of global modernity, as people look for ways to detach themselves from systems they recognize as oppressive. But, and this is a whole other discussion in and of itself, obviously some people get caught up in scapegoating and conspiracy theories and completely romanticize and colonize notions of what our ancestral pasts looked like and how people behaved through different ages. And in practice, obviously, our work has nothing to do with any of those things and is actively anti those things. But I suppose from an outside perspective, some of the trappings might look or sound related to those things. And because the mainstream media and so on, you know, like to generate fear and hype and, you know, just hysteria, when these things are latched onto, you know, this is the image you get, like the Unabomber or something, you know what I mean? Like that might be someone's image of what someone who's anti-civilization or whatever is, you know? And therefore, like, people might have an aversion to the very possibility of ancestral and land reconnection as a mode of being in action because of fascist co-optation of just the mere aesthetics of what we do, you know? So how do we account for the presence of these violent movements and ideas in the same sort of general spheres that we operate within? And how can we make very clear what we stand for?
Yeah, thank you so much for this question. It's such an important one for us to engage with. And it's very real, right? I mean, we both have direct experience of it, you know, and yeah, I mean, I suppose where I'm at with it is to be as... I suppose to be as vocal as I can be in, I mean, I believe that like these things are integral to what I do anyway, to, you know, be as anti-racist as possible and to be constantly engaging with that and to be like speaking about oppression and the many ways that it shows up in our lives and in our work. In the hope that like speaking about these things will deter those people from turning up to my courses, but that's not really what you're asking, you know. It's like, okay, I don't want those people turning up to my courses because I want people to feel safe there. And I want to feel safe in my work. But like, yeah, it exists and it's very close. At least on the surface, it looks very close from an outsider's perspective. And I really like, I don't have the answer of, you know, what do we do about these people? You know, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's just a matter of making sure the people that are targeted by such groups know that our spaces are created for them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, not for the nasties.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know as well that like, we've already touched on this of like, there are like, accessibility issues, like, you know, I want to be inclusive in my work, but I know that like there are parts of my work which are exclusive to like exclusionary, not intending to be, but like, you know, people are coming into the woods and sleeping out in the woods and paying money, and it's like, by its very nature, people are going to be excluded from that, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that I can't see and can't understand because I don't have a lived experience of it, of why like certain things might be difficult for people. Like I remember my friend Peter Michael Bauer over in the States, who I'm like really inspired by the way he engages with rewilding. I am, you know, talking about trying to you know, bring more people of color into the organization, and like not seeing how bringing people into the woods was a really traumatic experience because that's where so many of their ancestors were killed, you know. So it's like trying to learn about what are the things that I can't see, you know, like what are the parts of this which are not welcoming to people, like how am I participating in that as well. And trying to address that and trying to be honest about that. Like it's really, it breaks my heart that so much of, you know, like I was saying before about like the mythology or like the work that I love, like the work that we love, not even the work, like the flipping, like the land that we love is appropriated in such a way as to like propagate and like a hateful message and one that like is destroying people. And I don't know what to do about it. Only to like keep creating spaces where people feel welcome to come to like
And I guess, you know, try to inform people that we work with who may not know as well about it, you know, try to inform them what's going on, or I guess if we see something they don't or whatever. Yeah. You know, because that's what you would expect of friends and community anyways, is for it to point out each other's blind spots too, you know.
Yeah,
in as gentle a way as possible, like.
Yeah. And I think it's so important, isn't it? Like we've definitely had that feeling in activist culture before where I didn't, you know, the methods of calling out were like so destructive, you know. So like how do we do that in a way that doesn't destroy a community and a place that is so important for people to be able to feel like they can connect with. Because we are the people that are here doing this work now, you know.
Yeah, because I think, like, you know, this scapegoat of the social justice warrior or whatever, you know, it's the idea that they're trying to strive for this impossible perfection, you know, that no one's allowed to make any mistakes or whatever. Whereas, and really, that's not what, you know, both our projects are social justice focused, and that's not what we're trying to do. It's, you know, it's opposite of that, really, you know.
I love that in your workshop, you know, like addressing something as difficult as talking about white supremacy with people and like starting off by saying, like, this is the place to say the wrong thing. You know, this is the place to, you know, like there's no there like as much as possible, like we're not gonna have judgment in this space about like the wood that you need to burn, you know, like that's our responsibility as like white people coming together to do this work on the land of our ancestors is like we need to talk about the difficult stuff in a way that like we can really fully explore and go into it, you know, so that it can be dismantled.
The great cultural theorist Stuart Hall, this is where I got that from. He said that an anti-racist teaching space needs to actually be racist, because people need to be comfortable to say the things that are in them, so that those things can actually be addressed and we can work on them. Okay, well, thanks so much, Lucy, for your time. And I know you went over time with me as well. So thank you so much for
Yeah, no, thank you. It's so easy to chat to you, and
that.
yeah, I just really appreciate the your questions, you know, and I so appreciate your work. Like it feels so good that you're here and that you're doing this. Like it was, I think I was so excited when I found when you sort of launched your project. It's such needed work, and I really love and I'm grateful for the way in which you're doing it. So yeah, thank you, and grateful for your
Oh,
friendship as well.
thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your work and your presence in my life and your friendship and everything too. Thank you so
Yay.
much.